Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet 'em, greet 'em, treat 'em, and street 'em. Today's date is May 25th, 2021, and I'm your skeptical host, Ken Milne.
The title of today's podcast is, Do You Gotta Be Starting Something, like TPA before EVT?
And our guest skeptic is Dr. Gareth DeBeegan. He is an emergency physician at Maine Medical Center in Portland and a clinical assistant professor with Tufts University School of Medicine. He also works at an urgent care and a rural critical access hospital. Gareth is interested in wilderness medicine and is the co-director of wilderness medicine clerkship at Maine Med and the medical director for Saddleback Ski Patrol and for Maine Regional NSP. At work, Gareth imagines himself as a student of evidence-based medicine, trying to provide the best care to patients based on the best evidence. Welcome to the SGEM, Gareth.
Thanks, Ken. Long-time listener, first-time guest, though I did actually win the Keener contest twice.
Well, the skeptical prize does exist, and you have to play to win and win to find out what the Keener contest prize is. But in your introduction, I was so excited to see that you have some rural blood running through those veins.
It's true, Ken. And much like your hospital, the critical access hospital I work at considers massive transfusion when we give both units of blood.
Yes, the massive transfusion protocol. But I was looking at this episode and I'm starting to worry that if I keep having all these episodes on stroke, people are going to think this is the Skeptic's Guide to Stroke, the SGS, as opposed to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Yeah, you know, I guess for a group of non-expert contrarians, we do spend a lot of time trying to educate ourselves on topics.
Easy there. You got to let that one scab, okay? We do cover other EM topics on the SGEM, like, I don't know, TXA, cardiac arrest, sepsis, POCUS, ketamine.
Yeah, so Ken, I actually went and looked back into your last 20 episodes, and only three of those 20 were covering stroke. So sure, that's a lot of stroke, but proof that you do cover other important issues while trying to cut down that KT window.
We do cover other issues. But let's start this episode off with a case.
Okay, so a 74-year-old woman presents to your emergency department with 1.5 hours of right-sided weakness, aphasia, and neglect. On rapid bedside assessment, you calculate her National Institute of Health stroke score, NIHSS, of 11, and a field assessment for stroke triage for emergency destination, the FAST-ED score, of 7. Based on these, you suspect a large vessel occlusion, an LVO, and a non-contrast head CT shows no evidence of intracranial hemorrhage. A CT angiogram plus CT perfusion demonstrate a clot in the left proximal middle cerebral artery with a small infarcted area and a large penumbra. Based on your institution's current guidelines, the patient is a candidate for endovascular therapy, but they are also within the current window for the administration of thrombolytics. You wonder if you got to be starting something. Specifically, you wonder if you should be giving thrombolytics while waiting for the endovascular team.
Well, management of acute ischemic stroke has been discussed on the SGEM ever since this knowledge translation project was launched back in 2012. My position remains that there is some uncertainty as to whether TPA provides a patient-oriented outcome, a POO. And this was summarized in the downgrading of the NNT recommendation to yellow with Dr. Justin Morgenstern from First 10 EM.
Yeah, and the world of stroke management has changed a lot in the last few years with much more robust evidence to support endovascular therapy, EVT, for LVO strokes. The tipping point came with the publication of Mr. Clean in 2015. This was a multi-center, randomized, unblinded trial of patients with an LVO stroke in the anterior circulation treated in less than 6 hours after symptom onset. The primary outcome here was good neurologic function defined as a modified Rankin score of 0 to 2 at 90 days. The trial included 500 patients and reported an absolute risk reduction of 14%. That was 33% for people who had EVT and 19% in the controls. This gave an NNT of 7.
Four other RCTs were stopped early due to the publication of Mr. Clean. Now, all four of these RCTs were published in the New England Journal of Medicine in the subsequent 6 months. So there was Swift Prime, which had about 200 patients roughly, and it reported an NNT of 4. Then there was Extend IA with 70 patients and an NNT of somewhere between 2 and 5, depending on which outcome you picked. Revas CAT had over 200 patients and extended the window out to 8 hours and gave an NNT of 6.5. And then the fourth paper was Escape, and it had over 300 patients. It too was stopped early, but it extended that window out to 12 hours and reported an NNT of 4.
So there are problems, though, with stopping trials early. Dr. Gordon Guyatt wrote in the BMJ that it can introduce bias towards efficacy. And he said that you should have a high level of skepticism regarding the findings of trials stopped early for benefit, particularly when those trials are small and replication is limited or absent.
I love when smart people encourage me to be more skeptical. A systematic review and meta-analysis was published in JAMA 2015 looking at EVTs for stroke. The first three RCTs reported no superiority. And then, boom, along came Mr. Clean. And those four additional studies that were stopped early after the publication of Mr. Clean. The forest plot shows a point estimate that favors EVT. And that 95% confidence interval around that point estimate does not cross the line of no statistical difference. But we need to be careful not to overinterpret this data because of the bias mentioned before of stopping trials early. And those four trials that are stopped early, that bias that's inherent in those studies could have been compounded by meta-analyzing them in a systematic review. I will put the forest plot in the show notes for people to look at.
A couple more RCTs were published since that 2015 meta-analysis. Dawn, in 2018, had 206 patients, and it showed an NNT of 3 between 6 and 24 hours. Unfortunately, this was also stopped early. Diffuse was also published in 2018 with 182 patients. This showed an NNT of 4 between 6 and 16 hours. It was also stopped early. We will put a table in the show notes that lists all of the studies and the number of patients enrolled per center per year. The average was only 4.6 patients per year from each stroke center.
Well, the NNT for EVT does look like really impressive. I mean, we don't have a lot of things with an NNT in the single digits. I think this summary statistic is suffering from denominator neglect. Once the patient is getting the intervention, the NNT does look good. It's somewhere between, 3, 4, 5, 6, somewhere in that neighborhood. However, how many possible stroke patients were screened and how many code strokes were called to get these impressive NNTs for the endovascular therapy trials?
Yeah, most of these trials didn't tell us how many patients they screened to get the ones that they registered. Only one of them did, which was Extend IA. In that RCT, they screened about 7,800 patients, but only registered 70. That's about 0.9% or 1 out of 110 that were eligible for the treatment. The NNT in Mr. Clean, the largest and arguably the most methodologically sound of these trials, was 7. So if you must screen 110 patients to find one eligible and then need to treat 7 to benefit 1, then about 1 out of every 770 patients having a potential stroke would benefit from this therapy.
Therefore, we think that the NNT provided for the RCT suffer from denominator neglect. An NNT of 770 is not nearly as impressive as an NNT of 7. The agenda is in the numerator, but the devil is in the denominator. One major component of LVO management is the use of systemic thrombolytics in patients presenting within the current window for thrombolytic treatment prior to EVT. However, it's unclear if systemic thrombolytic administration results in better outcomes or if it simply exposes the patient to an increased potential risk at a higher cost.
So there is a systematic review and meta-analysis by Mistry et al. It was published in Stroke 2017 on the issue of endovascular therapy with or without thrombolytics. They included 13 studies for about an N of 1,769 patients, with three RCTs, which only accounted for 25% of the patients, and then 10 observational studies, which accounted for the other 75% of patients. They reported an NNT of 17 for good neurologic outcome, and with an EVT plus TPA compared to EVT alone. However, it was not as statistically significant if you only looked at the RCT data. This is a problem with combining lower quality observational studies with higher quality RCTs.
Well, we've looked at a 2020 RCT by Yang et al. Published in the New England Journal of Medicine on SGM number 292. This trial asked if EVT alone was non-inferior to EVT plus TPA in stroke patients with LVOs presenting within 4.5 hours of symptom onset. The cohort consisted of 654 patients, and the key result was EVT alone was not non-inferior to EVT plus TPA. Our SGM bottom line was there does not appear to be a role for systemic thrombolysis in acute ischemic stroke for appropriate patients where EVT is readily available.
Two more trials have been published, and that is what we're going to review today on the SGM. Today, you're going to get a twofer. That's two for the price of one. Oh, and that price is zero. So this is all part of the free open access to medical education initiative.
Oh, I love spreading the good FOMED around. So, Gareth, what's the clinical question we're going to try to answer on today's SGM podcast?
Today, we are going to ask, does intravenous thrombolysis prior to mechanical thrombectomy increase the percentage of patients with LVO who achieve a modified Rankin score of 0 to 2, that's functional independence, at 90 days?
And you mentioned this is a twofer, yep, two for the price of one, that price being zero. What's reference number one?
Reference number one, Ken, is Suzuki et al., the effect of mechanical thrombectomy without versus with intravenous thrombolysis on functional outcome among patients with acute ischemic stroke. This is the SKIP randomized clinical trial published in JAMA 2021.
All right, let's run through the PICO. What was the population?
Population was patients aged 18 to 85 evaluated at one of 23 different stroke centers in Japan within 4.5 hours of onset. These were found to have an NIH stroke score of greater or equal to 6, a CTA or MRA, proven ICA or M1 occlusion, minimal imaging changes of ischemic stroke. Patients had to be previously independent and meet Japanese criteria for thrombolysis.
And there were a number of exclusion criteria, and we'll list those in the show notes. What was the intervention?
They performed mechanical thrombectomy of the LVO without additional thrombolytics.
And they compared it to what?
They compared this to thrombolytics, specifically alteplase, given at a dose of 0.6 milligrams per kilogram in addition to the thrombectomy performed within 30 minutes of randomization.
And just to call that out a little clearer, that's 0.6 milligrams per kilogram, which is lower than the standard dose of 0.9 milligrams per kilogram of TPA. And we'll discuss that a bit more. How about the outcomes? What was the primary outcome?
The primary outcome was for a modified Rankin score evaluated by physical exam or phone interview at 90 days.
And how about the secondary outcomes?
They had a couple of secondary outcomes. They looked at an ordinal shift analysis of the modified Rankin score. They also looked at patients who had an MRS of 5 to 6 or an MRS of 0 to 1 or an MRS of 0 to 3. They looked at 90-day mortality, successful reperfusion, recanalization, and of course, adverse events, specifically ICH.
And the author's conclusions from Suzuki et al. Were, quote, among patients with acute large vessel occlusion, mechanical thrombectomy alone, compared with combined intravenous thrombolysis plus mechanical thrombectomy, failed to demonstrate non-inferiority regarding favorable functional outcome. However, the wide confidence intervals around the effect estimate also did not allow a conclusion of inferiority. End of quote. All right, let's go through the quality checklist for randomized clinical trials. The first question is, are these emergency department patients?
You know, we're not sure, Ken, but we do think so. They did not say if all the patients came primarily to the ED, were referred from other hospitals, or may have included inpatients, but it seems likely most of them came through the ED.
Were they adequately randomized?
Yes, they were.
The process of the randomization itself, was it concealed?
Yes, Ken. They specifically said patients were randomly assigned in a one-to-one ratio of one of two treatment groups using a web-based data management system, the mechanical thrombectomy alone group or the combined group. And using a stratified permutated block method with block size of 4, we balanced the number of patients into two treatment groups of each hospital.
And were the patients analyzed into the groups which they were treated? Now that means a per protocol analysis. That is the more appropriate analysis for non-inferiority trials.
Yes, they were.
The study patients, were they recruited consecutively?
Unsure, Ken, but we think probably yes. They did not list how many patients were approached for eligibility, but were then excluded in their table 1.
And we've seen that in other stroke trials, so that gets at the denominator neglect. So how many patients did you actually have to consider the diagnosis of stroke or call a code stroke to get into that first box on table 1? All right, the patients in both groups, were they similar with respect to prognostic factors?
Unsure, Ken. The combined therapy group had predominantly males, 72%, versus the thrombectomy only group, which was more balanced with 56% males. We do not know that sex would prognose a different outcome, but sex must be considered as a possible confounder.
All right, the seventh question. Was it a blinded trial?
No, this was an open label trial.
Were all groups treated equally except for the intervention itself?
Unsure. They do not state how post-thrombolysis care may vary from post-thrombectomy care.
Did they have complete follow-up?
Yes, they did.
And were all patient-important outcomes considered?
Unsure. We think it's a yes. The modified Rankin score has been the standard outcome for stroke trials. However, as pointed out on previous episodes of the SGEM, it's an imperfect measure.
And the 11th final question, the treatment effect, was it large enough and precise enough to be clinically significant?
No.
All right, let's go through those results. They recruited 204 patients into this trial. The mean age was 74 years. 63% were male, and the median NIHSS score was 18. What was the key result, Gareth?
EVT alone was not non-inferior to EVT with TPA.
The old double negative. Okay, let's go through the primary outcome. And that was the favorable neurologic outcome defined as an MRS score of 0 to 2 at 90 days. What did they find with their intention to treat analysis?
Their intention to treat ITT analysis showed 59.4% with EVT versus 57.3% with combined EVT and TPA.
So that gives an absolute difference of just 2.1%, and they were unable to conclude non-inferiority. But we like to see the per-protocol analysis, because that's a more conservative analysis of a non-inferiority trial. So what did they find with their per-protocol analysis?
Their per-protocol analysis showed 60.8% with EVT versus 58.8% with EVT combined with TPA.
So that gives you an absolute difference of around 2% again, and they were unable to conclude non-inferiority. How about the secondary outcomes?
There was no statistical difference between the groups in any of the secondary outcomes except for adverse events.
Yeah, if there's one thing I'm confident about is giving thrombolytics increases bleeding. There was a 13% absolute increase in intracranial hemorrhage with EVT plus TPA compared to EVT alone. However, symptomatic intracranial hemorrhage was not statistically different. All right, Gareth, this is the first time we get to talk a little nerdy. You ready to talk nerdy with me?
Ken, I've wanted to talk nerdy with you for a long time.
Yes, I love it when people want to talk nerdy with me. All right, so the first point is about non-inferiority trials, and I think that's an important one to go through because the second trial is also a non-inferiority trial. This was designed to show that one therapy is not significantly worse than another. Now, this study, quote-unquote, failed to show this based on their delta. What was the difference they were looking for? And the delta they were looking for was an odds ratio, OR, an odds ratio of 0.74. Now, they reported an odds ratio of 1.09 favoring EVT alone. But when you looked at the lower part of the 95% confidence interval, it dipped down to 0.63, which was lower than their odds ratio that they set a priori of their delta of 0.74. So this trial also, though, does not demonstrate superiority of EVT alone or equivalence. Those are very specific definitions, and I think people need a visual usually to see that. And so I am going to put a picture in the show notes to explain that a bit further.
The second nerdy point, Ken, is external validity. This trial was conducted in Japan, which introduces two differences. Japan uses a dose of alteplase of 0.6 mg per kg rather than the 0.9 dose that we use here in North America. This was discussed on the SGEM number 325 when critically appraising the THAWS trial with Professor Fadovich. One could argue that a higher dose may have made a bigger difference, but it also could have increased the risk of bleed. It is not clear how this would have affected the results. Also, the reason that a lower dose is used in Japan is because Asians are reported to have a higher rate of intracerebral atherosclerosis. This was based on Kim in 2014. So it is not clear how this would change the results if we applied this data to Western populations.
The third nerdy point is about secondary outcomes. In this study, they found no difference on most outcomes. The only difference was higher rates of bleed at 36 hours in the group which received TPA, so the combination therapy of EVT plus TPA. And yet, symptomatic head bleeds was not statistically different between these two groups. Despite this, we know that intracranial hemorrhage can predict a worse prognosis. Further study would be needed to clarify the relationships between thrombolytics, intracranial hemorrhage, and worse outcomes.
Subgroup analysis is worth considering as well. As mentioned in the checklist, there was a larger percentage of males in the combination therapy group than in the thrombectomy-only group. However, in subgroup analysis of gender, also of age, atrial fibrillation, blood glucose, antithrombotic agent, NIHSS score, and randomization time, there was no difference between the groups. This suggests that sex was not a major factor in the outcomes.
And we should be careful when looking at subgroup analyses. And if they had found a difference, I think it would be an overinterpretation of the data to claim, aha, we found something significantly different that was quote unquote true. Because I think that these subgroup analyses that are showing benefit should be hypothesis generating and confirmed in subsequent trials. All right, the fifth point was about power calculations. The authors cite in their limitation section that they calculated a non-inferiority margin of 0.74. That's the delta. So what that means is the combination therapy is not more than 26% worse than thrombolectomy therapy alone. The authors state three reasons this may not be the correct margin or the correct delta. First, the margin is based on prior data using the standard 0.9 milligrams per kilogram rather than the 0.6 milligrams per kilogram used in this trial. Second reason was that the margin was selected using a fixed margin method rather than a minimally clinically important difference. And third, favorable outcome in this study were more frequent than prior data. Finally, we would add that being an open label trial may alter the data results, also affecting the power calculation. But you know what, Gareth, at the end of the day, this is all hand waving. This is all post hoc rationalization. It doesn't matter because we do not need an estimate of effect size. That's what you're doing when you're setting a power calculation. We don't need to estimate it. We already have it in this cohort. We have the data set. It's already been determined. What's left for us is not to do a post hoc power calculation. What's left for us is to interpret the 2.1% absolute difference between the two interventions that were not statistically different and an odds ratio that the point estimate favored EVT alone. I hope that's not too nerdy for everybody. All right. Gareth, it's time to comment on the author's conclusions and compare them to the SGEM's conclusions.
We generally agree with the author's conclusion on this study.
Now, before we get into the rest of the standard SGEM critical appraisal form, let's bring in reference number 2 and go through it in a similar fashion. And then we'll get to those other parts where we have to give a bottom line, talk about the clinical application, and what you're going to tell the patient. So what's the second reference we have for this twofer?
So reference 2 is Z et al., the effect of endovascular treatment alone versus intravenous alteplase plus endovascular treatment on functional independence in patients with acute ischemic stroke. This is the DEV-T randomized clinical trial, also published in JAMA 2021.
All right, you've already practiced on paper number 1. Let's run through the PICO on paper number 2. What was the population?
Patients age 18 years of age or older with CTA or MRA proven ICA or M1 occlusion stroke eligible for treatment with TPA in 4.5 hours from last known well.
All right, there's exclusions in this trial, and I'll list those in the show notes. What was the intervention?
The intervention was EVT of an LVO without additional thrombolytics.
And they compared it to what?
Standard dose TPA. This is 0.9 milligrams per kilogram in addition to EVT.
All right, let's run through their outcomes. What was their primary outcome?
Primary outcome was the proportion of patients achieving a modified Rankin score of 0 to 2 at 90 days, evaluated by 2 blinded neurologists based on voice and video recording.
And what did they report for secondary outcomes?
Secondary outcomes included distribution of the MRS at 90 days, an MRS of 0 to 1, reperfusion on angiography during the EVT procedure, reperfusion on CTA or MRA, change in the NIHSS at 24 hours and between 5 and 7 days, and an EQUAL 5D, that's the European Quality of Life 5 Dimension score, measured at 90 days.
So the conclusions from Z et al. Were, quote, among patients with ischemic stroke due to proximal anterior circulation occlusion within 4.5 hours from onset, endovascular treatment alone compared with intravenous alteplase plus endovascular treatment met the pre-specified statistical threshold for non-inferiority for the outcome of 90-day functional independence. All right, let's run through those 11 quality checklist questions quickly. Were these emergency patients?
Again, we're unsure, but we think yes. It is not explicitly stated in this manuscript.
Did they adequately randomize them?
Yes.
The randomization process, was it concealed?
Yes.
The patients were analyzed into groups to which they were treated, again, a per-protocol analysis for non-inferiority trials.
Yes, a per-protocol analysis was also performed.
And the study patients were recruited consecutively.
Unsure. It doesn't explicitly state this, but I believe so. However, one of the exclusions was if the investigator thought that the patient was unlikely to follow up at 90 days, and another 51 patients declined to participate, but no additional information was provided on those patients.
The patients in both groups were similar with respect to prognostic factors?
Yes.
Was it a triple-blinded study?
No. Patients and clinicians were aware in this open-label trial. However, outcome assessors were blinded.
All groups were treated equally except for the intervention.
Unsure. Once again, they do not state how post-thrombolysis care may vary from post-thrombectomy care.
Was the follow-up complete?
Yes, they had a 0% loss to follow-up rate.
A nice round number. All patient important outcomes were considered.
Much like with the prior study, modified Rankin score has been the standard outcome for stroke trials. However, as pointed out, it's an imperfect measure.
And the 11th final question, was the treatment effect large enough and precise enough to be clinically significant?
No for effect size, but yes for precise enough to be clinically significant.
All right, let's run through the results. They assessed over 500 patients for eligibility, so they told us how many people they screened. More than half were excluded, with only 235 patients, 46%, ultimately being randomized to either EVT alone or EVT plus TPA. The median age was 70 years, 56% were male, and the median NIHSS score was 16. What was the key result for this second study?
key result here was EVT alone was non-inferior to EVT with tPA.
All right, and that primary outcome was a favorable neurologic outcome, or an MRS, of 0 to 2 at 90 days. What did they find with their per-protocol analysis?
Per-protocol analysis showed 53.2% with EVT versus 46% with EVT plus tPA. This is an absolute difference, was 7.1%, with a 95% confidence interval from minus 5.9 up to infinity. And beyond, they were able to conclude non-inferiority because less than their pre-specified 10% delta.
And how about their secondary outcomes?
There was no statistical difference in any secondary outcome except for adverse events.
Yeah, as in the other RCT, there was a statistical increase in intracranial hemorrhage when you had the EVT plus tPA, or the combo group, compared to the EVT alone group. But the difference in symptomatic intracranial hemorrhage was not statistical. All right, we get to talk nerdy a second time, and I'm going to give you the opportunity to go first.
Great, thanks, Ken. Our first nerdy point is on TIAs. One of the secondary outcomes measured in this study was INEH stroke scale at 24 hours. We know from NINS Part 1 that thrombolytics was not superior to placebo for NIHSS score at 24 hours. Furthermore, in this study, successful reperfusion was found in 3 patients, that's 2.6%, who received thrombolytics prior to thrombectomy, and in 2 patients, that's 1.7%, who did not. This clearance of clot suggests that thrombolytics do not have a major role in clot clearance.
The second nerdy point was about stopping trials early. This study was another trial that was stopped early. They stopped after enrolling only about a quarter of the patients. They had powered their study to have an N of 970, so almost 1,000 patients they were going to recruit. And they stopped at 235 because of a statistical finding of likely futility. However, we know that stopping trials can introduce a form of bias, and this bias can be compounded when included in a systematic review and meta-analysis. It would have been nice to continue enrolling more patients, unless, of course, that there was clear evidence of harm. However, stopping studies early usually makes a study more likely to find a non-true benefit, rather which this study did not. So we're more likely to believe this data.
Third point is the M1 versus M2 occlusion. In both this study and the prior one, only patients with an ICA, that's the internal carotid artery, or an M1, that's the first segment of the MCA, occlusion, were considered candidates for enrollment. But many institutions will perform thrombectomy on patients with M2 occlusions or an ACA occlusion. It is not clear if patients with smaller, more distal occlusions would be more or less likely to benefit from intravenous thrombolytics.
The fourth nerdy point is about intracranial hemorrhage rates. NINS and subsequent other trials report intracranial hemorrhage rates of around 2 to 6%. This study, in contrast, found intracranial hemorrhage rates to be about 22% for thrombectomy only group and 32% for the combination group. This is a much higher rate and similar, but lower to that previous study we just reviewed, the SKIP trial. It had an intracranial hemorrhage rate of 34% versus just over 50%. Clearly, this data supports that LVO has a much higher intracranial hemorrhage rate than other strokes, and therefore thrombolytics may carry even a higher risk to patients than we had historically considered.
Our final nerdy point is comparison to prior data. Prior evidence has suggested that patients who received intravenous thrombolytic therapy had better outcomes. However, this came from observational data. It is possible, even probable, that the patients who were not given intravenous thrombolytics had contraindications, which also were predictors of poor outcome. This is now a third study with data suggesting no benefit from adding thrombolytics to thrombectomy. As further data come out, practice may shift. Also, this further data raising the possibility that intravenous thrombolytics may not provide benefit to any stroke patients and may provide impetus to re-perform NINS or ECAS-3 with our newer imaging technology.
All right, that's the end of our two sections of Talking Nerdy. It's now time to comment on the author's conclusions and compare them to the SGEM's conclusion.
Once again, we generally agree with the author's conclusions.
Well, then it's time to give an SGEM bottom line.
The SGEM bottom line here is that we now have three studies that have now suggested there may be no significant difference in patients with LVO who are treated with only thrombectomy versus those who are treated with combined thrombectomy and intravenous thrombolytics.
And how about a case resolution?
In our case, per your hospital protocols, you call a code stroke. The neurologist comes and assesses the patient. They order intravenous alteplase and await their neurointerventional colleagues to evaluate the patient to see if she may benefit from thrombectomy. After your shift, you email your facility's stroke neurologist to open a discussion about your hospital protocols and consider if thrombolytics should be removed from protocols for patients with LVO.
And how are you going to take these two new studies and apply them clinically?
Current data support careful consideration of potential benefits and potential harms of systemic thrombolytics in patients with LVO. Consideration must be given to patients who are candidates for interventional procedures. As more data are available, current protocols should be reconsidered. Further studies are pending, specifically Mr. Clean, No IV, Swift Direct, and Direct Safe.
So what are you going to tell the patient then?
I would talk to my patient and say, your symptoms are due to a stroke. The CT scan shows there is a clot in an artery in your brain. We have a team here that may be able to remove this clot like we do in heart attacks. There's also a clot-busting drug that may help to break up these clots. Data suggests that adding this clot-busting drug to the clot removal procedure may not improve your outcome. However, we do not have definitive evidence and current guidelines still support using these clot-busting drugs. Let's discuss the potential benefits and potential harms of this drug with you and your family to see if it is something you would like to try.
You see how that's a nice shared decision model at the end, not saying, hey, you have to do this, the guidelines say. It's time to announce the Keener Contest winner, and last week's winner was Dr. Kristen Johansson, an ED physician from Williamsburg, Virginia. Now, we did get a lot of correct answers, and a number of people suggested Teddy Roosevelt. But the president that we were looking for was President Ronald Reagan, who was shot in the left side of the chest. What's the Keener Contest question this week?
Our question this week is, what year was the first known use of the word penumbra?
Ooh, I like the term penumbra, don't you? It's up there with gestalt, penumbra. You know, it just sounds so sophisticated. But if you know the answer, and the question is, what year was the first known use of the word penumbra used? Then send an email. Send it to me at thesgem@gmail.com with Keener in the subject line. That first correct answer will receive a cool skeptical prize. And I just want to remind everybody, just like the other SGEM episodes now, you can get CME credits for what you're already doing, listening to the SGEM. Now, the content will always be free, but there is a small fee if you want to claim CME credits. And this will help support this free open access to medical education project. Well, thank you, Gareth, for coming on the SGEM and being the guest skeptic.
Thank you, Ken. It was a pleasure to be here, and I hope I'm welcomed back.
Oh, I am quite confident that you will be a repeat SGEM guest. But until that next episode, can you read the SGEM tagline?
Ken, I live in Maine, which is known for a great accent, and I grew up in Boston, also known for a great accent. Unfortunately, I can't do either of them. But I will tell you to remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it here on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.